All right, good morning. Welcome to the end of week four. For those of you tuning in from home, there was no Wednesday. Instead, there was a quiz. I'm told, in fact, this was left at the quiz. So someone from Cabot House, we have not only your water bottle, but also still your water. Is anyone from Cabot House here that would like to claim this? No? All right, I'll leave it with the teaching fellows in case that's your water. So a couple of announcements. One, if you are interested in getting savvy with something beyond Nano, and Nano is great for something simple. It's great for those of you who haven't programmed so much before, but it also lacks a lot of the more advanced features that a lot of so-called text editors do have, among them Emacs and Vim. So HCS is going to be offering a hands-on seminar today in Science Center 229 at 4 p.m. on Vim, which is an alternative to Nano. So do check that out if you might be interested. Problem set 3 will be released, as before, on the website tonight in standard and hacker editions. Problem set 2, comment on this. So in the hacker edition, if you yourself did it, or perhaps you know some of your friends who did it, it was also about crypto, but the hacker edition had folks cracking, so to speak, these 6 passwords. And to crack a password generally means to figure out what that password is. What we gave to those students who did the hacker edition were 6 usernames, followed by colons, followed by the encrypted versions of their passwords. The encryption used was a variant of DES. If you recall the algorithm that we looked at briefly in lecture a couple weeks ago, DES having any number of 72 quadrillion possible keys. So these passwords here were encrypted with a variant of DES, and I thought we'd take just a second to reveal what some of the passwords were. Some of those students' code, I believe, is still running on nice.fas, trying to crack some of the passwords. But most of them were, in fact, cracked, and hopefully you'll find a bit of humor in at least some of them, since they're all drawn from popular culture. So M. Scott, as today's introduction might suggest, is of course referring to The Office, Michael Scott, the Steve Carell's character. And if you recall, a few episodes back, an IT guy comes into his office, asks him what his password is, and not only is it on a post-it note, it is also just 1, 2, 3, 4. So the first password, cryptic as it looks there, as 50VK7WH and so forth, that actually decrypts to 1, 2, 3, 4. And I think most of our Hacker Edition students did get that. D-Helmet as a reference to what popular film? So Spaceballs. So I thought I would indulge us in a couple of minutes of a look back at this film and reveal to you what that password was.
What's going on? What are you doing to my daughter?
Permit me to introduce the brilliant young plastic surgeon, Dr. Philip Lutton, the greatest nose job man in the entire universe at Beverly Hills.
Your Highness.
Nose job? I don't understand. She's already had a nose job. It was a sweet 16 present.
No, it's not what you think. It's much, much worse. If you do not give me the combination to the air shield, Dr. Slotkin will give your daughter back her old nose.
No! Where did you get that?
All right, I'll tell.
No, Daddy, no, you mustn't.
You all right, my dear? Who knows? But I will not tell the combination no matter what.
Very well. Dr. Slotkin, do your worst.
My pleasure.
No! Wait! I'll tell.
I knew it would work. All right, give it to me.
The combination is... 1.
1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5. So the combination is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's the stupidest combination I've ever heard in my life. It's the kind of thing an idiot would have on his luggage.
Thank you, Your Highness.
What did you do? I turned off the wall. Why didn't you turn off the whole movie? I must have pressed the wrong button.
Well, put it back up.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right, fixed.
We're back. And we have the combination.
What?
We're done with it. Go back to the golf course and work on your putts.
Let's go, Arnold. Come, Gretchen. Of course, you know I'll still have to fill you with this.
It's about to be inappropriate.
But she gives great helmet.
PG.
It's PG.
It works, sir. We have the combination. Great. Now we can take every last breath of fresh air from planet to radio. What's the combination?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage. Prepare. Press 4-1 for immediate departure.
Yes, sir.
I changed the combination on my luggage.
Okay, so in increasing order of difficulty, to some extent, Homer was the next username. His password, and perhaps this isn't so much increasing order of difficulty, was just beer. So that too, quite simple. But notice the pattern thus far. So even if you didn't think so much about the Hacker Edition, or even look at it, if you just imagine how you might have gone about cracking these passwords, well, certainly trying, guessing possible passwords is one technique. And the first two passwords clearly would have been cracked by any algorithm that just tried, certainly all possible numeric combinations. And then Homer's, in turn, would have been cracked by any algorithm that tried all possible alphanumeric ones, but maybe even better yet. Right? There's a lot of combinations of letters and numbers that you can come up with, but this word is interesting in that probably in a dictionary. And so one of the things we gave to the students who did the Hacker Edition was access to a large dictionary, in which this was one of the words. Now they got a little more interesting. So Steve Jobs' password turns out to be iPhone, which presumably would not have been in the dictionary. And in fact, the capitalization might have thrown those students off. But a few of you did, in fact, get this. Bill Gates, in turn, was Windows. However, the I was a 1, and the, whoops, I can't spell, and the O was a 0. So this is actually a common heuristic, at least among tech folks, whereby to more easily remember your passwords, you sort of choose a real word, but you substitute combinations like letter numbers that look like letters for those letters. The downside, of course, is that if this is a common trick that a lot of tech people use, well, it's also not that hard to crack. So any of you who implemented in your crack utility a heuristic whereby I's became 1's, or L's became 1's, and O's became 0's, you too would have cracked this one, and I think at least one of you did. And finally, to my knowledge, no one got Malin's password, which was ultimately, and if that makes sense to you, that's why you were doing the Hacker Edition. And if you're not sure, ask the person who laughed next to you. So the quiz. We'll be grading the quiz on Monday at our staff meeting. Grades will be available that night and returned. Okay, yes. So for the win is what you're all whispering to the person next to you. FTW. So those will be returned next week. Finally, any questions before we dive in today? Any questions at all? All right, so today we're going to conclude with a look at some additional problems. Not so much C syntax, not so much programming functionality, but approaches to solving problems. And the first of those is this relatively workaday problem of making change. So you go into a convenience store and you are due some change. Suppose you are due 44 cents from the cashier. If you are that cashier, how would you go about providing me with 44 cents in change? What would be your algorithm? And you have access, clearly, to then a drawer full of bills and coins. What's your algorithm? Let's go with the first hand. Any of you who have ever had a real-world job? Yes? Perfect. So start with the biggest coin possible and then work your way down. So in that case, assuming you have access to quarters and dimes and nickels, you would start with a quarter and you would pluck off that part of the problem. So 44 cents, I pull out a quarter, what am I obviously left with? The 19 cent problem. Now I've got 19 cents. I can't pull out another quarter because that's going to give me back too much change, and so I work my way down to dimes. And then I work my way down to nickels and then pennies. Is that the optimal solution? That is to say, if I'm a really anal customer and I don't like carrying around more bills and coins than I need to, and therefore I demand of this cashier, give me as few bills and coins as possible, will that algorithm in fact give me the fewest bills and or coins possible? Well, okay, so the assumption here is that we don't want the cashier to lose money. So I can't just keep the change. All right, handing me back a dollar would might indeed be the optimal solution otherwise. Yeah? Okay, so if I gave them more change, as some of you sometimes do, just so you get back a nice even coin amount or an even bill, that's fine. But even there, that's too much math for me, right? Because we've all run into the cashier who you give them, you know, 3 cents to sort of round up to the next coin, and that throws them off completely. So that's not an option, right? So no giving additional coinage. You're only giving, say, you've given some amount and you are due 44 cents. And you're demanding that the cashier give you the fewest number of coins possible. If that cashier executes this algorithm of going from the largest possible coin on down to the smallest, will that quite simply solve that problem of optimality? Yeah, so it turns out it will. Given the U.S. currency system and even the EU's relatively new currency system with the euro and such and their cents, you will mathematically end up giving back the fewest number of coins and or bills possible if you take what we're going to call a greedy approach. That is to say, the cashier in this case pretty much looks at the cash drawer and then works their way down as greedily as possible, biting off as much of the change problem as possible on each iteration. And by biting off a piece, I mean taking the biggest bite out of the problem, the 44 cent problem as possible. And as you propose, the first such bite is a 25 cent bite, which then leaves us with 19 cents and so forth. And ideally, we whittle our way down to zero. Now, there is a catch. This algorithm only works if what is true about that drawer. So you have to have enough, it turns out, of each of the various coin types and or bills. And we'll see that in a second. So just to formalize, here's a very trivial example of what it would mean to make change for a 29-cent problem using this so-called greedy approach. You pluck out a quarter, that leaves you with a 4-cent problem, and obviously the next bite you can take out of that, so to speak, is a 1 cent. 1 cent, 1 cent, 1 cent, you're down to zero, and you're done. So in this case, the optimal number of coins, it seems, that you can return to the customer would be just 5 coins, a quarter and the 4 pennies. But what about other contexts? So this is actually, I tried to pick something that wasn't completely arbitrary, but was in fact drawn from the real world. So a few years ago, when stamps were a little cheaper, there existed in yesteryear these combinations of stamps, a 34-cent stamp, a 21-cent stamp, and a 1-cent stamp. Let's ask that same question now. Suppose that I need to, because of what the Postal Service has told me, put 44 cents worth of postage on an envelope, because that's what its weight dictates. How many stamps am I going to end up putting on this envelope? All right, so 4, why? Well, which? All right, so 2 21s and then 2 1-cent stamps. That certainly gets the job done, but here's the interesting thing. Had we taken that very simple, greedy approach of starting with the biggest denomination and working our way down, I mean, the envelope would look ridiculous, right? Because if we took a greedy approach, how many stamps would we have put onto this envelope? So you'd put 11, right, a 34-cent stamp, and then you'd fill the thing up with 1-cent stamps, which is clearly foolish. But the interesting challenge here is, especially if we're trying to formalize what you all just did fairly rapidly, intuitively, is how you actually computed that solution. And I would argue that, simple as this example is, it's an example of a problem that really warrants what's called exhaustive search, trying all possible combinations of stamps so that you do, in fact, get back the optimal answer. And most of you in this room solved that problem incredibly quickly, but odds are, at least some of you started with the 34-cent stamp and then quickly realized, wait a minute, that's going to give me too many stamps. I'll short-circuit that sort of decision process and try again with the 21-cent stamp and where that gets me. But if we have many different coins or many different stamps, odds are the answer might not be as immediately obvious when the problem space itself is much larger. So I thought I'd formalize with a bit of pseudocode here, using some syntax drawn from Java and from English and such here, how you might express this idea of computing the minimal number of stamps possible for an arbitrary amount of postage. So here we are. We'll call this a function called howMany. Ultimately, it's going to return an int, which is just the number of stamps that is minimally possible. And the input is going to be the amount of postage we want to return. So this bit of syntax here essentially says, to solve the p-sized problem for each denomination d, determine the number of stamps required for postage p minus d, and then go ahead and return the minimum number found plus 1. Well, so what does that mean? Well, in the context of these stamps, how many times is this loop here, as begun by this upside down a, which denotes for each or for every, how many times is this loop going to execute? Yeah, so just three times. We're first going to try computing the number of stamps required for postage P minus 34. Then we're going to try solving the problem for P minus 21, then P minus 1. But how do you figure out the number of stamps required for P minus D? Well, you recurse, right? Use the same algorithm. And odds are once, so the pseudocode here doesn't quite make clear here the fact that there is a so-called base case. What's the base case, hopefully? Right, so remember in the context of recursion, the base case was just that line of code that hard-coded in an answer that said if postage is, say, zero or even less, we'll return zero because it's meaningless to continue further. So even the pseudocode is taking some shortcuts. But in spirit, what this is suggesting is that you try, in this exhaustive search approach, all possible combinations of stamps and see which one ultimately gives you the minimal amount. Yeah. So good question. How would this situation handle inputs for P that just simply aren't possible? So presumably, because we at least have the 1 cent denomination here, that should never be an issue with at least this particular context. If we took away the 1 cent stamp, we would have to change the code so that there's some way of expressing the idea of just not having the right type of denomination. And presumably it would be in the base case, because if you don't physically have the right denominations, P at some point would go negative because you wouldn't be subtracting off the perfect amount. So you would probably handle it in that way. Okay, but the point here, though, for now, is just that when you have a search space that you have to check the entirety of, that is, you have to try, in theory, all possible combinations, or certainly more than just one, it can get expensive very quickly. And let's see if we can't express and feel this in a more programmatic context. So this is an example of a sequence that you're probably familiar with from some former math class called the Fibonacci sequence. So this is often introduced in the context of rabbits mating and the populations of rabbits increasing, which was always such a stupid example. I'd never really found it compelling. So we're just going to present the mathematics. And suffice it to say that there are applications that are actually interesting of the Fibonacci sequence. Golden ratio stuff, rabbits, and other things. But for now, we're just going to look at the mathematics. This is a function that's defined as follows. If the input to this function is 0, the answer is 0. If the input's 1, the answer is 1. Otherwise, the answer is the answer to Fibonacci of the previous value plus Fibonacci of the second previous value. So in that sense, this simply gives you a sequence of numbers that starts with 0, which is the so-called 0th Fibonacci number, 1, what's the next number in this sequence? All right, so 1, because we add these two. Now we add these two, which gives us 2. Now we add these two. Now we have 5. Now we have 8. And it goes on forever. So the first question at hand is, how can we go about implementing this? Well, this is sort of a prime candidate for what new technique that we've seen over the past few days. All right, so recursion. So let's quickly whip this up. And I apologize, incidentally, how warm it is in here today. We called over to the powers that be. And apparently, when it's unseasonably warm, they have no control over the air conditioner. They made a decision last week that now it is cold out, despite what it is outside. So that's the way it's going to work, unfortunately. So here's a quick framework. And we'll actually look at the Fibonacci stuff in a second. So here is fib1.c. What we have here in the main routine is just a way of testing what I'm about to try out. So we have up here, this check here. So ensure proper usage. So all this is doing is checking argc, and if it's not equal to, it's bailing out because we want this program to be executed with one command line argument after the program's name. And what this program ultimately is going to do is just answer this question. What is the ith Fibonacci number? And it's going to compute it for us using the mathematics that we saw above a moment ago. So what's this line doing here? Perfect. So a to I recalls a function that takes ASCII and converts it to an integer, assuming that's mathematically, that's actually possible. So argv of 1 is exactly the first real command line argument after the program's name. It's storing the result in n. And I'm just doing a sanity check now here. What if n is less than 0, I just want to quit. And it turns out, and even though you guys had to be more anal with your implementation of Caesar and actually checking that the command line argument was in fact numeric, if you looked closely at the documentation for A to I, what does A to I actually return if you pass it something that's not actually the string representation of a number? sort of a good question, right? Because several of you, most of you, probably spent time with an extra for loop iterating over every character in argv of 1 to make sure that it was entirely numeric, calling isDigit, isDigit, isDigit. Here I seem to be making a leap of faith. I'm just assuming that the user typed fib of, say, 1, as opposed to fib of foo, where foo is clearly not an integer. Well, how can we answer this question? What does a to I return if, in fact, argv of 1 is not actually a number? 1, 0?
Negative 1.
All right, so that's 3 possible answers. How do we figure this out? So we can try it. We can look up a reference. Let's try the latter real fast. So just to get you all in the habit of answering these questions too, I think, again, one of the best references here is this one, C/C++. Let's go to string and character, A to I. And it looks like if the conversion cannot be performed, then A to I will return 0. So that's good for us, good for my program, because it means my program's not going to break. It's going to handle that case just fine. Your programs, though, we had you jump through the hoop of actually essentially checking whether or not argv of 1 was in fact numeric so that your program was even more robust than mine, and so that 0 was in fact for you a valid key, whereas I can't distinguish that from otherwise the user typing 0. But for now, it looks like our value is stored in n, and if n is in fact 0 or greater, I'm going to go ahead and print out f of s for Fibonacci sequence of whatever the input is equals this. LLD, what's that? Yeah, so that just refers to a long, long value, a long, long decimal value. And then we're going to pass in these two values here. So notice here is the call to fs of n, which is going to be the function. And close your eyes real fast while I delete the code. Nope, there we go. How do we implement fs of n? So again, here is the function. And the nice thing about recursion is that it lends itself so cleanly to implementations of ideas that themselves are recursively defined. So how do we implement this function? So if n is what? 0. I'm going to go ahead and return 0. That seems fine. Else if n equals 1, let's go ahead and return 1. And now here's the interesting part. Else, what do I want to return? Of n minus 1 plus fs of n minus 2. And that's it. I mean, that's sort of the beauty of recursion, that you can express something that goes on forever like this and is defined mathematically like this, but really it translates perfectly into something like C. So let's try this out. Assuming I rewrote that correctly, let's go ahead and run GCC of fs1, enter, and it did compile. I'm going to go ahead and run it, and now there's the usage information. If you fail to run it with an argument, let's go ahead and run it on 4. We seem to get back 3, so 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, so that checks out. If we do one more of these, 5, okay, so good, not so bad. What if we go up to 10? So the 10th Fibonacci number is 55, what if we go up to 20? Okay, not bad, the 20th Fibonacci is 6,765, what about 25? Okay, it's 75,000 or so, 30. Okay, not bad, how about 35? Okay, so it seems to be slowing down, that's about 9 million, what about 40? So now it's really slowing down, even though the code is the same. So this looks like it's, what, 102 million, give or take. Let's push the limits a little more. Let's just go up to 42 and see what happens. And it's not all that much bigger, right? I'm just going up step 2 this time. So what's going on, right? My code hasn't changed. And this is pretty pathetic. So now it's a bigger value, so it looks like it's 200 something million. Let's push it a little farther. Let's just do 50. It's not even a huge number, right? We're dealing with longs. I just want Fibonacci, the 50th number, which I could probably figure out, you know, if we spend a bit of time here on the board. We get big, but we could do it. Why is the computer so damn slow? Yeah. Yeah, essentially. So why are we, in fact, every time we increment by 1, almost doubling the number of steps the computer is performing?
Because it starts out, when you first define functions, it starts out saying, okay, I need a value for 1, or 0 for 1, and 0 for 2, and I need a value for 3, and 3, so I go on every single time for each.
Exactly, and let me hone in on that word you used. You keep recycling, or not even recycling, you keep recomputing the same values again, right? Look at how this thing is defined. Every time you want to call Fibonacci sequence of x, you're actually performing two more queries. Well, how many queries do you need to execute to answer each of those in turn? Well, two, and then two more, and then two more. And that process only stops once you hit one of those base cases. So conceptually, and let's see if this thing's still not even done. We're still computing the 50th Fibonacci number. What you're really doing is something like this. So this here is a little diagram that's meant to help you visualize exactly what's going on when we call f of s on, say, 5. So in the very top of this sort of family tree here, we see fs of 5, which just means that fs of 5 is invoked. Well, what does it mean to call fs of 5? Well, it means, per the definition of our code, to call fs of 4 and then fs of 3. But those in turn mean calling fs of 3 and fs of 2, and fs of 2 and fs of 1, and so forth, all the way down to those so-called leaf nodes, if we're calling this thing a tree. So only once we hit 0 or 1 does the whole process stop, and then the rest of the computation proceeds. So just to compute the fifth Fibonacci number, how many times does it appear that fs is called? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 times just to compute the fifth Fibonacci sequence. And notice how quickly we did that ourselves. I mean, arguably, the computer is now getting slower than the human at this task. And eventually, it'll still beat me. But what's stupid about this implementation, clearly? So it's not writing them on the blackboard, but so what? So there's no memory. That is to say, it's not remembering computations it's already done, right? How many times does f of s of 1 get computed in this picture? Well, it looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 separate times. But what's the answer? Well, it's 1 every time. So why are you recomputing that value 5 different times? And if you think now not of fib of 5, but fib of 50, this tree, so to speak, is getting huge. In fact, let's take a look at this program. It's still not running. So I'm going to kill it with Control C. We'll let that be. And let's go ahead and compile FS2. And we're going to introduce today, and with problem set 3, a new technique for compiling code. Starting with problem set 3, as you'll see later tonight, you're going to be compiling sometimes more than just one file at once. And you can do that with GCC, but it often means typing multiple lines, multiple commands with GCC, so that you compile first file, second file, third file, and then the fourth command sort of combines everything together, links them together, so to speak. Well, it turns out there's a nice tool for automating this called Make, which is a tool we'll start using. And it turns out that you can even use it for compiling single files. So rather than type GCC of fs2.c, starting now, I'm just going to type make fs2. I'm not even going to mention the file name. And notice that somehow the system figured out what I wanted to type. And it executed for me GCC and then that long string fs2.c and then that long string. And notice what it even tossed in for me for free. -lcs50, which eliminates my needing to even remember that at this point. So typing make henceforth will be a useful trick. And we'll put this in print in problem set 3 for you as to how to use it. We'll begin to save you time. And we'll begin to eliminate errors as well. So now I have not just a.out from my previous invocation of GCC, but it actually names the program according to the file name, which is nice. So let's run fs2. Again, the usage is the same. So let's run it on 5. So that's pretty quick, but notice what I did. With this version of FS, I instrumented it, so to speak. I added a couple of lines of code that essentially keeps track of how many times the function was executed with certain inputs. So what this is reporting is not only the answer in the first line of output, but it's also telling me how many times each Fibonacci number was computed. So let's try 10 now. So now fib of 10. It looks like now fib of 1 is called what? 55 times alone. Not so good. What about 20? Well, 20, notice what begins to happen. Essentially, this is a flat top to bottom representation of the same data. All right, let's push it a little further. 30. So if you call fib of 30, you are invoking fs of 1 and fs of 2 800,000 and 500,000 times just to get back the answer 1 and 0 every single time, let alone all the other invocations. What about 35? sir, you can start to feel the slowness again and notice that these leaf nodes, again, 5 million times just to compute the 35th Fibonacci number, which frankly we could Google and figure out faster, but about 40. So there too, this is when it began to feel a bit slow. We did get an answer last time. So let's see exactly how many times the worst of these things is called. So that looks like 63 million times now, just to compute the 40th Fibonacci number. And if we go back to 50 again, odds are we won't see an answer for quite some time. And it's because of what's effectively exponential growth. Every time you call fs of something, you're calling the same function twice more, twice more, twice more, which suggests that the size of your tree, the running time of your program, doubles essentially every time you increase by just one the question you're asking it. Yeah?
Why is one called way more times than zero?
So think about, essentially it works out because when you keep subtracting one at a time, you end up hitting this. If you pair thing numbers up, you end up hitting it here, and you end up hitting it here. But you also hit it, if you see where I'm going with this, you hit it again on the number one when you sort of subtract one each time. So that's all. We'll come back to that, though, if you want. OK, so how do we fix this, right? Clearly, recursion's nice in that it does save me development time. It's incredibly clear how the function works, but it's not necessarily the solution to all problems. In fact, it's unclear even what the right solution here has been thus far. Well, let's take a look at this other fundamental technique. So recursion is sort of one technique to solving a problem, and sort of another approach to solving problems in general is this idea of dynamic programming, the spirit of which is essentially to take a large problem and, yes, break it down into smaller problems, but generally to remember, as you proposed earlier, remember what those solutions are. Combine past solutions to give you newer solutions that you care about. And memoization specifically is what we're looking at here. This is not a typo. It is, in fact, memoization, not memorization, even though it actually coincidentally is similar in spirit. But take a look at this. In FS3.c, we have the following. So I have, again, my main routine, which really doesn't do anything all that magical until we get to this point. And this uses a bit of cryptic syntax that you will soon understand in a week or two when we look at pointers and dynamic memory allocation. But for today's purposes, suffice it to say that these few lines of code here that I've just highlighted create dynamically an array that's as big as I need it to be. Right, because we don't know when this program is run in advance what number the user is going to type in. So this chunk of code that I've highlighted is a way of creating an array of a certain size when you don't know, when you first wrote the code, how big that array needs to be. And there are other ways to do this, but we put forth this syntax today just so you get a glimpse of where we're going. But it's not all that complicated, as you'll eventually see. But what is interesting and what is familiar is this stuff here. So suppose now that I have an array called memo, and it is plenty big for our purposes now. Why do you think I'm storing in the zeroth location of the memo the number 0? Why is that relevant, do you think? Yeah, so fib of 0 is 0. So think of this array now that I'm creating as really like a scratch pad where I'm going to write down all of the Fibonacci numbers from smallest to largest up until the point where I actually care about the answer. The idea being I don't now need to recompute all of those values again and again. I can just look back on my so-called scratch pad in my memo for the answer I already computed. So therefore, I don't have to constantly recompute again and again and again these same values. So this here, I know, you know, before the program's even run, what the first value is supposed to be. So I'll just hard code that, a sort of base case, if you will. I also know what this one's going to be. Now, technically, I know what the rest are going to be, or at least a lot of them, because I can look them up. I can figure them out. But we do have a computer, so we'll at least let the computer figure out the rest of those. Minimally, we have to tell the computer these two. And so I do. I store in my array called memo both the first Fibonacci number and the second one. And then this, these lines here, I'm doing something a little unusual. So that loop is doing what exactly? Translate it into English. What's that loop doing?
Marking all of the other elements in the array to, like, know that they're unassigned.
good. So essentially, I'm filling the rest of the array with something that's called Sentinel, apparently. And it's all caps, which by convention usually means that it is some kind of constant. And indeed, that's true. And up at the top here, we see that Sentinel is a long, but I've prefixed it with this new keyword, if you've not used it before, called const, which just means its value cannot change. It's very similar in spirit, though this is a bit more robust than the approach you have seen, which is where we did sharp define. And then we also declared a constant this way. The difference for those that are interested is that this constant has a data type. Sharp define does not actually give you a data type. It's just a literal value. So you have to be more careful. It looks like I'm initializing this to -1. So what this is doing for me is essentially making some kind of notation in this scratch pad that I've not computed that value before. None of the fib numbers can be -1. So the idea is that if I put -1 there in advance, that's just sort of a mental cue to me that I don't know what that value is yet. I haven't initialized it. This is in contrast, for instance, for just leaving it 0. If it were 0, you might confuse it for an actual value. And you don't want it to just be garbage values that are just there when your program starts. You actually do want to initialize it to something you know. And I'll arbitrarily say that it's going to be -1. And I'll refer to it as Sentinel so that I can declare it just once all the way at the top. Now notice, the only thing that changes now is my implementation of FS. I'm still doing the recursive calls. Notice that the last line of actual code here, I'm still returning, ultimately, FS of n minus 1 plus FS of n minus 2. But notice my base case has changed. Rather than just checking is n 0 or 1, the question I'm instead asking is, do I have an answer to this question already? Well, how do I figure that out? Well, I just check the nth location in my scratch pad called memo. And if it does not equal Sentinel, what must it equal? Just conceptually. It must equal the answer to that problem n. Well, how did it get in there in the first place? Well, this is this clever one-liner here, which I'll blow up to make it more clear in a second. This line here not only has the effect now of returning fs of n minus 1 plus fs of n minus 2. Take a guess as to what it's also doing simultaneously. It's also caching that answer and tucking it away in the array before actually returning. So if I wanted to be ever more clear, I could actually change this code to be this, where we store the value in the memo, and then we return memo of n. And we do that in two separate lines, but that is equivalent to what was just written there a moment ago. And it was just meant to give you a sort of nice shorthand notation. So what's the upside of this? Again, the takeaway seems to be we're still doing things recursively, but instead of just waiting until we bottom out at these so-called base cases in this whole recursive process, we're checking, rather, have we answered this question before? And we look to our memo for that answer. And if it's there, we just return that as per this blinking line, as opposed to recomputing it yet again. Well, let's see what the takeaway is. Let's go ahead and save this, even in its modified form now. I'm going to type make fs3, which is the new shorthand notation for compiling. It seems to compile OK. I'm going to run fs3 on 5. All right, not all that interesting, still just as fast. What about 20? Still just as fast. What about 40? Still fast. 50? Still fast. So we seem to have eliminated that ridiculous inefficiency, because the running time now of FS in this new implementation is what in terms of big O? It's now big O of N. Because intuitively, even though there's this recursion, which might suggest this doubling process, we're short-circuiting immediately, such that the question to ask is, how many times on input n are you computing every other Fibonacci number? This time around, just once. Because once you compute it, you remember it. And subsequently, you just look it up to figure out the next answers. So well, let's do one more. Let's even push our luck. Let's go up to 60, which there's no way the other version would have solved in time. Still pretty darn fast. And I'm using a long recall so that we can get these really big values on the screen. Yeah?
What if your first input has something?
What if your first So if your first number starts on, so in this case, 60 is being computed here, right?
Yeah. But
so isn't that what I'm doing here, though, by typing fs3 of 60? So the input's still 60. So the recursion is happening. But what isn't happening this time is that the functions aren't being called more than is necessary. So how to say? So essentially, the recursion is still happening. So when I ask for the 60th Fibonacci number, the program is still computing these two, which requires computing these two, which requires computing these two, all the way down. But once you get here and you have the second value, what's happening is that we no longer need to call FS yet again for all those same values, because we're remembering what this value is and just using it again and using it again. Yeah?
I think you guys have like persistency between executing the program. Like that FS of 40 then fills in all those values and then it uses them the next time too.
Okay, so if that's the question, as soon as this program quits, all of the work I've done is thrown away. It's not remembered. So what is being remembered is the answers to these questions, so that essentially you're short-circuiting this tree. The idea is then, if we were to redraw this tree, you would begin to see FS3, for instance, as a leaf. You would see FS3 having children only once in the picture, if that makes sense. You're not computing all that additional work beneath it. So afterward, I'll stick around if you want to take a look through some of these, step through this more slowly. But for now, at least let's make the takeaway be just the significant improvement in performance here. Okay, so a couple of words on software now, especially as we look to problem set 3, which again will be released tonight via the course's website. So one, a reminder, grading software, and this is more of a course philosophy than any sort of universal rule. The metrics into which we've broken the evaluation of your code are along three axes: the correctness of your code, the design of your code, and the style of your code. What do we mean by this? Correctness just means if you read our specs carefully and you make your program do exactly what our PDF tells you to do, then it is perfectly correct. It might be the most hideous thing in the world. It might take forever to run. But if it works as prescribed, it is correct, so to speak. It's in design that there's inherently more subjectivity and more instruction on our part. It's the design axis along which we say, yes, your code works, but I don't even know how this code is working. Or look how much slower your code is than it could be if you made these changes. Your code is doing work that it doesn't need to, as in the case of FS1 and FS2, and so forth. The kinds of questions we can push back on you with will vary, certainly, from program to program. But design is really your opportunity over the next several months to improve as coders. Correctness is not as hard to satisfy the requirements of. And style, in turn, is something that's purely aesthetic. Your code might work perfectly. It might be brilliantly implemented. But if there's not a single comment, if all of your variables are called X, Y, and Z, if nothing is indented and it's instead flush with the left-hand side, or your program's one huge long line of code, that is bad style. Right? And this is something that we've begun teaching largely by example and by way of section, but it's style that's purely aesthetic. And frankly, if you're losing points on style, you're throwing points away unnecessarily. Because in the first couple of problem sets, we haven't graded style. You've been getting full credit for it, but your teaching fellows have typically been commenting, this is bad style, or better variable names next time, please, or indent this properly. Because the style is something that's more of a religion, more of a habit that one gets into, and so we didn't want to expect as much too soon in the course, but do realize that you should be looking to lectures examples and book examples and your TF's examples as to what constitutes good, pretty code, good style. A word on grading as well, especially coming on the heels of the first quiz. So there seems to be this concern among many of you still that you are disadvantaged by those more comfortable in the course because they have more experience. They're going to do better on the quizzes. Therefore, when they might get an A, you'll get a B, even if you're doing quite well. So know that that is not our intention or plan with the course. There will absolutely be students in this course come term's end who are absolutely brilliant with this stuff. And they've taken every possible computer science course and they taught themselves C 15 years ago. And they'll get an A. But there will also be students in this course who have never programmed before 4 weeks ago and who came into this course without any computer science background, but who do the work, who follow along, do well, and they will also get an A. There will not necessarily be a distinction made come grade time between those more comfortable and those less comfortable. So realize if you're in that latter category, this really is, I think, the type of course where if you do put in the time and you work hard at it and you ask questions when they arise, but you generally do a good job on your work, it is the kind of course where it's very doable to get an A or an A-. You should not feel yourselves inherently disadvantaged by those more comfortable. So enough on that for now, unless you want to talk privately. So finally, designing software and debugging software So we'll say more on this over, in time to come, but what I want to introduce today is a glimpse for you at a program called GDB. And this is something that you'll look at in sections this coming week, as well as be urged to start using in office hours. Thus far, if you have been trying to fix your programs or find bugs in your programs, what techniques have you used to try to figure out where the bugs are in your code? Besides clicking the hand icon and writing your name on the whiteboard. Yeah. Okay, printf, right? Printf has probably been your friend. If you want to figure out what's going wrong with your program, odds are you've been told to or you've just figured out, why don't I just start printing variables values? Why don't I print some text so I see where problems are coming up? And that's perfectly reasonable. And to this day, that's still a technique that I and I presume all of the TFs still use on occasion, but it's not a very powerful technique, if only because it doesn't scale very well when you've got lots of code, and it's also a pain because you have to constantly recompile and re-execute your code just to see some slight change. The program we are going to begin urging you to get comfortable with is a program called GDB, for GNU Debugger. This is just a program that has the ability to run your programs, but at a much slower pace, and to allow you to run them line by line, your programs, and actually look inside of those programs at the contents of variables before it proceeds to take its next step. The idea being, if you as a human can walk through your own code on paper, that's great, but much better if you can actually run through your program on a computer and take a look internally, poke around at it, pause execution, resume execution, watch the various variables, and generally have much more control over what's going on in your program. So to give you a sense of this, take a look at gdb.c here, which is a very simple, silly program that does nothing interesting except highlights a few uses of C syntax and such. So in my main routine, I've got an int a. I'm calling a function foo, passing it a. It's got a return value in turn foo, does some stupid stuff with math, declaring b, assigning b to n. B gets multiplied by 2. I called bar of b. Again, this is completely random sequences of statements because I just wanted something to play around with. So what I'm going to do here is run GCC, but not just gdb.c. I'm going to add a so-called switch called dash g, which essentially tells GCC to include some additional information underneath the hood that will help me debug this with a program like GDB. The output is the same. I still have a.out. But if I now run a.out, this program is going to do that. That's all it does at the end of the day. It prints hi, I'm bar. But if I instead run GDB of a.out, I get this prompt, a blinking GDB prompt, and I can also here just type run, and that's going to run my program. Completely uninteresting. But watch this. If I type break main, notice it says a breakpoint 1 is now in file gdb.c line 20. So it figured out where main starts in that file. Now I'm going to go ahead and type run. Notice now, nothing's printed yet because the program has paused execution where main begins. So this first blinking line is the first line of code in my program. Nothing has happened yet. If I print out A, notice that it prints out 1. Well, why is A 1? Well, it's some garbage value, right? You can't trust that your variables will be initialized to some value usually, so A apparently is 1. But let's do this. Let's execute that line of code. So let's move on to the next one, thereby executing what's line 20 in the file, which looks like this. Now if I hit next, that's the next line of code that would be executed subsequently, but now let's go ahead and print out A again. Looks like it is in fact 5. And you'll get more familiar with what it means to be a dollar sign 1 and 2. These are little shortcuts, but the point for now is that you can step through your code. Let's type next again. Okay, it printed hi on bar. Why did it print that? Well, foo is a function that called bar that I think called baz or something like that, and it printed out that by a printf. But that's not interesting enough to me. Let me start over. Let me rerun it. It's going to say the program being debugged has already been started. Do you want to restart from the beginning? Yes. I'm going to say yes. I'm going to type next again. But this time, I don't want to step over foo and just let it get executed. I really want to dive in and see what's going on inside. So I'm going to type step, which has the effect of stepping into the function foo. Well, the function foo, recall, looks like this, just as a visual refresher. It looks like this. So that's where we are now. So let's take a look now at what's going on. So if I print out the value b, it's 5, because b was passed in as the value a originally. Again, silly little function. Let's hit next. If I go ahead now and print out b again, what should I see? So 10, because it got multiplied by 2. And there are other little tricks. You can hit display and constantly display the value of a variable every time you hit a key so that it constantly reminds you of it. Once we get to pointers and things, you'll be able to look at even more sophisticated things. And in section this week and again at office hours, we'll introduce you to more techniques with GDB. But this sheet here is meant to be hopefully a sufficient cheat sheet for using GDB. And I would urge you to poke around with it. And really, you'll learn by playing around with a teaching fellow by your side. This is a more exhaustive reference, the two-sided one. But for now, take a look online tonight for problem set 3, and we'll see you next week.